Around Comics, Episode 9.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Around Comics, where every week we assemble a new panel to discuss topics in and around the world of comics. I'm your host, Christopher Niesman, and I am joined, as always, by my partner in crime and the producer of the show, Brian Salazar.
Hello, everyone.
Rounding out our panel today is a mainstay of the show. He is also our guide into the world of manga. He is Matt Summer.
Hey guys.
Welcome to the show, Matt. This is our fourth week in a four-week series of shows taking a look at the world of comics. In our first episode, we looked at the continuity of the current DC universe. In our second show, we looked at the House of Ideas and everything that is going on in the world of Marvel. Last week, Bruce Rosenberger was on the show to help us take a look at the larger independent and alternative press market. And this week, we are going to look at manga and its place and effect in the world of comics. We'll start with Matt. You are a huge manga fan and have been for quite some time. I want to start out, and we're going to do this as kind of a history lesson slash informative show on manga, assuming that a lot of the listeners haven't stepped into that that playground in comics. Matt, what would your definition of manga be?
To me, I mean, manga basically is very simple. It's comics that come from Japan. For our discussion, any comics that come out of Japan and the Japanese publishing houses there.
Well, you know, one of the reasons that we're looking at manga is because of its increase in sales. It has come from Japan, and it has made a serious impact in the sales of comic books as a genre. Now, there are people that would say that manga is not in the same genre as mainstream American comics. Would you agree that it is complete and separate from mainstream American books?
Yeah, I have to say, looking at the demographics, looking at who's buying manga and who's making this manga boom successful right now, there's really very little crossover in the readership, and there's very little crossover in actually how the books sell and how they're marketed and where they're sold and that kind of thing.
Is it manga or manga, or does it matter?
Well, you're going to get your purists that are going to say it's manga, and it technically is manga if you pronounce it in the proper Japanese, you know, way. Japanese only has five vowel sounds. So it's pretty straightforward on how you pronounce things. Now, obviously, any word that we adapt and comes into English usage, you know, is subject to change. Now, I just say manga because that's the way I say it. I know that that's not really necessarily correct, but, you know, it depends on whether they're going to be a hard ass about it or not.
Like Chris.
It's the difference between karaoke and karaoke.
They both suck.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, we have a listener email which talks about some of the manga sales. This is from Simi on the forums, and it says, "Hi, Matt. I haven't been reading comics for that long, but I keep hearing about this huge manga sales figures. What I'd like to know is just how big the presence of manga is, and how does the rest of the American comic industry fit in alongside it? I know where I am from, Melbourne, Australia, there appears to be more manga available than regular comic books. I've read a couple of mangas since the Monster Review, Eden Volume 1 and 2, which I really enjoyed, and Pilgrim Jagger?
Yeah.
Volume 1, which I didn't like so much. I'm definitely impressed enough to look into it more." So I guess the question is, you know, how does manga fit into the American comic industry?
Well, it's going to be a really long-winded answer, because I want to go back to kind of talking about where manga started in Japan, where it started in the U.S., and then kind of where it is now. So let's do that first. Now, here's your real nerdy kind of thing. The word manga actually in Japanese means random or whimsical pictures. And it originated in the late 18th century. But manga as we think of it today really originated in the 1940s, which was at the end of World War II and during the American occupation. Japan, not necessarily a super powerhouse of prosperity. And so manga was a cheap, real readily available entertainment source for the people at the time. Now, most of you guys have probably heard of this person to talk about now, but the guy that's referred to as the father of manga, the god of manga, he's sort of like Stan Lee, Jack Kirby, Walt Disney, and everyone rolled into one in Japan. And he's a guy by the name of Osamu Tezuka, who did Astro Boy, who did a lot of other things, Blackjack, Phoenix, Buddha, Adolf, a bunch of things that we've seen translated here. He's really credited with the person who invented single-handedly the style and kind of the techniques and the way that things go, using really cinematic camera angles and using the big eyes. And let's talk about that a little bit. I know that's one of the things bugs people when they look at manga for the first time. You know, what the hell's up with all those big googly eyes? Seriously came from Tesla in the 40s, watching things like, Bambi and Disney movies and Betty Boop cartoons and things. And if you go back and look at it, they all have that really big, big eye.
So style. You're saying it's Betty Boop's fault?
Yeah, basically it is. And so, and he kind of set a lot of the stage for the people that were going to come after, and so it just sort of stuck. Kind of a cultural, this is the way we draw comics, is draw them, with these kind of exaggerated features and, really expressive looking eyes that could show a lot of emotion and things.
Now, are artists in manga, are they restricted from drawing in a hyper-realistic style? I have seen some styles that differ, but that seemed to be the mainstay, is the, the very, what I would call an anime, large eyes, very cartoonish.
Well, what happened is that style, really simplified style, an exaggerated big eye kind of style, that was pretty popular in the 40s and 50s. 60s and 70s in Japan came along, and the original readers were kind of getting older, and they were looking for more adult, kind of a little more advanced work. And so we did start getting some different styles. We started getting comics that are aimed at more, older men, like 18 to 25, as opposed to younger kids. And the styles change depending on the seriousness, usually, of the book and who it's aimed at. So, for example, for comics that are aimed at men or adults, you're not going to see that kind of style. If you've looked at the Monster volume and that kind of thing, you can see that's very, well, it's still sort of a little bit exaggerated in some ways. It's still a lot different than what you're maybe typical.
Well, a book like GTO, it looks very American in its style.
Okay, right. The people now, like in the 80s and the 90s, obviously they're being influenced still by films, by American TV and other things that they're seeing, and so that is coming into the style, and that has changed. And again, like I said, depending on what you're going for, every aisle, here, every artist has their own style. So, more or less, along kind of the same route, but...
Well, a lot of it, though, comes from, just the speed that they want to be able to produce things to. Also, it's a simplified form that lets them produce, incredible amounts of work, because they're doing these comparatively. I mean, aren't most books that come out manga style, it's more like 40 pages as opposed to 22, and they're, you know, serializing them in a lot faster rate. So I think, you know, initially they wanted a simpler style to try and be able to produce, you know, a lot of work in a short amount of time, where, you know, you're trying to do something hyper-realistic or you know, realistic look is going to take, obviously, much more a long time to do.
Right, let me segue into how manga is produced in Japan and the way that it comes out. You're right, that originally it was simpler to make it done quicker and faster. Now, as the years went along and production quality got better and you know, we get more technology and other things involved in the process, it gets more and more, you know, advanced, and they can get things done faster. Typically, the way the manga is produced is that they're magazines that come out, depending on, you know, who it's aimed at. There's magazines aimed at boys. There's magazines aimed at girls. There are magazines aimed at older men. There are magazines aimed at housewives. There's magazines aimed at kids that are like 8 years old. So all these magazines come out, and they're colloquially referred to as phone books because they're printed on really cheap, crappy newsprint, you know, usually multiple colors, usually about 500, 600, 700, 800 pages. And the exchange rate right now, I just looked it up, that for one of these magazines, like, the Japanese Shonen Jump, for example, it's about 800 pages, has about 20 different stories in it every week at about 20, 30 pages per story. That's going to cost you about $1.85 right now.
That's a value we're not used to here in American books. But you talk about all the different genres. One of the things that, you know, the figures that gets thrown around a lot is that upwards of about 80% of the population of Japan reads manga.
Japan.
I'm getting my A's and O's all messed up. About 80% of the population of Japan reads manga. Is that accurate, Matt?
It is pretty accurate. I don't have exact figures, but it's one of the reasons why you can't really compare the United States comic industry to the Japanese comic industry is that along the line, there's always been, the last like 30, 40 years, there's been a graduated step. So when you were a kid, you have comics aimed at you. When you're a teenager, you have comics aimed at you. When you're getting your first job in a corporation, there are comics about guys getting jobs in corporations. And for, you know, and there's manga about people who play golf. There's manga about people who play Mahjong. There's manga stories about people who, you know, are single parents. Whatever. There's, like, a story for everyone.
AroundComics.com, your source for discussion, news, and reviews about your favorite comics and creators. New podcasts available every Monday. Go to www.AroundComics.com.
Anyway, you know, one of the things that I did read in regards to that the listener email in the dollar amounts, I had read, and I don't have hard numbers to back this up, but that in Japan their weekly income from comics is sometimes more than the yearly U.S. market in dollars.
Yeah, I've heard that thrown out there too. I think where that comes from is the fact that each one of these magazines, like I mentioned, Shonen Jump put an 800-pound gorilla of manga magazines, and it's gone down, and Japan actually has had a publishing slump the last few years, but that magazine peaked at 6 million weekly sales.
Wow.
So, weekly. And so, yeah, I mean, it's a big part of their economy. Publishing is a really huge part of the economy. And it's, you know, it's big business. And part of that, too, I think has to do with that it is much more of a computer culture. And comics are just, you know, there's really not that much collector's mentality. Manga's available, you know, at any stand. You can, you know, people pick it up, they read it on the train, they throw it in the garbage can. You know, it's kind of like a more matter of fact part of life.
It's kind of like the USA Today. You just buy it at the newsstand, read it on the train, and then you're done with it.
Yeah, pretty much. Now, that's the weekly or the monthly kind of way that things are published. Now, what happens next is not very similar to what happens in the United States, where we get... if a series is successful enough in the weekly magazine, you know, after they get about 220, 240 pages, then they'll release the trade paperback or the collected volume. And that's really what we're seeing now, is that kind of digest size compilation of 200 whatever plus pages from the weekly book. And so it really does function in the same way, where it you know, puts it in a nicer format if you want to collect it, if you want to read it, if you missed the chapter, you know, you can go into the bookstore and it's going to be there. And again, as cheap as those have come become in the United States right now, those trade paperbacks, Japanese, they go for about 400 yen, which is about $3.50.
Matt, how many manga publishers are there in Japan? I mean, are there hundreds of them, or are there a select few big publishing houses?
Well, there's a lot of different, but the main three that I'm going to talk about that really are the biggest players are Suetia, Shogakukan is another, and those two are actually own Viz in the United States, and so that's why Viz gets a lot of licenses of like the hot properties, because anything that they own from those two companies, basically they have, I'm assuming they have first crack at. And the other big manga producer is Kodansha, and most of the stuff that Tokyopop puts out and all the other smaller companies in the United States are—they're mostly going through the Kodansha backstock.
Well, we've talked about manga in Japan and a little bit of the history and the publishers there. Let's bring it across the ocean and talk about how manga has come into the United States and how it's affecting this market.
All right. Now, this is all my own personal experience. So again, I'm sure that some people could maybe argue with me about this, but manga in the U.S. basically, I think, stems out of the black and white comic boom that was going on in the early to mid 80s. You know, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles hit it really big, and other smaller studios, then they were rushing to find, you know, quality black and white material to publish, and, you know, bam, here's this Japanese comics, you know, perfect wide variety of black and white stories that have never been reprinted before. The first comic I remember ever seeing actually was a book by the name of Ninja High School, which still is published now through Antarctic Press. A guy by the name of Ben Dunn grew up in Asia and was really influenced by a lot of these manga that he was reading, and so he came back here and kind of started his own comic that poked fun at some of these genre things and you know, giant robots and alien princesses and all this kind of stuff. And that's actually what I would say is the first, you know, original English language kind of manga style book that came out over here. But, and we'll talk more about what that term means later. Along with Ninja High School, we also had First Comics, which published Lone Wolf and Cub here in the U.S. with the Frank Miller covers. And we got Eclipse Comics that published My the Psychic Girl, Area 88, Kamui, which is a ninja kind of action story. Did you ever read any of those, or you remember those from the 80s?
I was a big fan of Lone Wolf and Cub.
Yeah, I read Lone Wolf and Cub, and my manga experience has been really limited. That I remember reading some Akira stuff, but not a ton.
Okay, yeah, well, those, I mean, everyone, now, Lone Wolf and Cub obviously was sort of hot for a while, and a lot of people that were around at the time remember that, especially from the Frank Miller kind of tie-in. Now, they didn't, also at
they,
the time,
they didn't actually finish publishing that, though, did they, before they went out of business first?
No, I think they published like 45 issues, and they published them in a square bound format that were like 48 pages, mm-hmm. I think, per book. So yeah, they got about halfway through, and then we'll talk about that later, but then Dark Horse kind of took over.
Well, so from my standpoint, as you know, just a comic fan at the time, I think I was like, you know, 12. I didn't think of it as manga or being from anywhere else. I just thought of it as just a different kind of comic. It was one of the first black and white comics beyond, you know, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles that I had ever read. So I didn't really feel a huge difference in it like I do with manga today.
Well, I think that's also maybe what the young readers now who are feeling that manga boom feel. But other publishers at the time, I mean, Epic published the first version of Akira in the U.S., and they actually colorized it, I guess. They didn't think that Americans maybe could handle black and white comics. Dark Horse came out with Appleseed and Ghost in the Shell and Outlanders, and that's a lot of what a lot of I find comic people now that have been exposed to manga, that's the kind of thing that they remember reading back in the early 90s. So I don't know, does that fit? Sal, did you read some of those? I think I remember you telling me that you read some of those before.
Yeah, Appleseed, I think I had read some of that. Yeah, I mean, I think you pretty much have a grasp on what most people would associate at that time.
Well, that you know, right, that brings up a point that I thought was that, you know, I read Ghost in the Shell, and of course I saw the anime of it, which I loved. Is there a connection between those in Japan? Are a lot of anime, are those adapted from manga or vice versa? Are they joined at the hip in Japan?
Yeah, basically what happens is that, you know, and we bitch about that here as comics, you know, being written as, you know, movie fodder or something, but the way that it works is basically if a manga series is successful, it's almost 100% guaranteed that they're going to make it into an animation. A weekly, you know, a television show, whatever, to air after, you know, like we have here, cartoons after school, what have you. So if it's successful, it'll get made into an anime series. Depending on how well the TV series does, then they'll keep making more episodes, you know, until they run out. And usually when the series is over, when the manga series ends, and the TV show uses all those storylines, then the TV show pretty much ends as well. Now, there's a few exceptions to that rule, but that's generally how it works.
Well, I think that was sort of my perspective on manga stuff when I first was ever introduced into it. Is I thought it all was spawned from anime. You know, I think like the first thing I ever came in contact with was, you know, Speed Racer was really the first sort of Japanese style anime style cartoon that I ever saw, and so I always sort of associated anything, you know, from Japan in the comics or animation world to that. And it's not necessarily very accurate, but I think it
a lot of people who haven't read a lot of stuff, that is what we kind of, you know, what their exposure is kind of what they think of. Oh, that's Speed Racer stuff, right? But yeah, that's understandable, totally.
And I think today you have it maybe even more, where you have, you know, Pokemon or Digimon or, you know, Dragon Ball Z or, you know, that stuff that you see all over the cartoon channels, and people certainly, you know, associate that with manga.
What's weird about it in the U.S. is the fact that we have the total back-assward way here. Because in Japan, it goes from manga to animation. And what we get here, because the comic industry up till now has been so insignificant to the general pop culture landscape, we've almost always gotten the anime first. And then if that's successful, we might see the ancillary, you know, comics mm-hmm. come afterwards. So that might be part of why we have that perception.
You're listening to Around Comics. It's like talking to your best friend's sister, and she's hot.
Let me continue on a little bit with the history of manga being published in the U.S. In the early 90s, we saw for the first time Viz, coming onto the scene, and they started out, and they made a lot of their sales by publishing the works of Rumiko Takahashi, who is, her big hit was Ranma, One Half, My Sonic Koku is another series, and so right now she's also, her latest series is Inuyasha. Okay, so that's even still going pretty strong for them. So that came along. They were kind of the dominant publisher for a while, but the thing that was really limiting and the reason why manga took so long to take off is the fact that they adapted a format that was never meant to be in an American comic style publishing format, and they put it that way. They sold these books at $3 a pop for 30 pages in a normal American comic book size. They flipped all the artwork so that it didn't read, you know, quote unquote backwards for English readers. They hired people like Gerard Jones and some other comic professionals to basically, in some cases, rewrite the whole script to make it, you know, appeal to Americans, what they thought Americans would want. And so that really limited it, and it kept the books, kept manga in the comic shop, you know, kept it in that little format that was going to be, you know, a monthly format, and then they'd come out with the trade paperbacks every once in a while that were, you know, 18, 20 bucks for the format. And what really caused the change in the industry here, and what led to the boom, is the entrance of a company that was called Mix, and they later on turned into Tokyo Pop. They were the first, really one of the first companies in the United States to attempt to publish a Japanese-style comic anthology with four or five series together on kind of cheap paper and try that format. And for what it was worth, it was pretty successful, went over pretty well. Now, it didn't take them long, unfortunately. They changed everything about what they were doing. They changed it from cheap newspaper to you know, glossy stock, and they started talking about video games and like hipster, I don't know, street tuning kind of whatever articles in their magazine. But what they did, what Tokyo Pop did, what they did to revolutionize U.S. industry is selling the manga in the small digest format for $9.95. That was their, you know, they really kickstarted this whole thing, because that got the books into bookstores, you know, a lot of pages for a good price. And what it did is it drove the industry. They saw, you know, they saw a lot of success with those sales. And so Viz, you know, said, oh, what are we doing? You know, we got to match what they're doing. And Dark Horse also, you know, they got a smaller, cheaper, you know, we got to follow suit. We got to get our stuff into bookstores. You know, it all became about price, and it all became about, you know, how many pages that you get in there. And that's really, I think, the key to what led us to where we are right now with this sales boom going on.
Which is kind of funny, because it's almost the opposite of what American comics do. You know, it's like, you know, cheap paper, black and white, huge, you know, big thick digest for a cheap price, as opposed to, you know, the American counterpart of that is, you know, either the Essentials or the Marvel Essentials or the Showcases, which is, you know, Golden Age or Silver Age stuff that they're reprinting, as opposed to brand new stuff trying to publish it. So it's kind of interesting that it's been, you know, extremely successful, yet you don't see Marvel or DC really trying anything like that. They're still going with, you know, high gloss, full color, 22 pages for $3.
Well, I think you're looking at the difference between the collector and the reader at that point. I don't know that many people that collect manga, but I know a lot of people that read it, and that digest format is easy for that. And you look at a bookstore, you know, anyone that's gone into a Borders or a Barnes & Noble and go to the manga section, which is usually, and I'm going to say manga and manga alternately here so I can piss everyone off. But if you go into those sections of the bookstores and you look at the manga section, it's very nicely kept, all of the books are pretty much the same size. You can follow a series right along and see where it starts and stops. And then you turn around and you look at the comic section where all the trade paperbacks are. I have yet to go into a store and look at one of those and go, oh my God, that is, what a mess. So, you know, from a retailer standpoint, it's a heck of a lot easier to shelf that stuff.
You're right. That universal kind of size that fits on normal bookshelves, very clearly labeled spines and things. You know, I go and you went to Borders or Barnes and Noble, and the American comic trade paperbacks, they're usually jammed almost like on a magazine rack or something. Like, they're all different sizes. You know, DC and Marvel have been really poor with like continual numbering of trade paperbacks. I think.
Well, they'll start it, and then they never seem to take it through. And then whenever they reprint it, it's a different spine. And so you may get, you know, volume one of, you know, Essential Fantastic Four, and then they'll reprint, and the spine will look different for volume two or whatever. And you don't see that with manga.
That's true. Right now, they have pretty much stabilized it. During the late 90s, before Tokyo Pop really kind of forced everyone's hand, there was a lot of variation, a lot of different sizes, a lot of different things. But right now they've settled on, like I said, basically what the publishers have settled on is the smaller digest size, a price point generally from $7.99 up to about $12.95. Viz really got aggressive for being kind of like the later person to the digest party. They really got aggressive on pricing, and a lot of their books, the books that they sell the most of, you're getting 240 pages for $7.99, which is, I don't know, a great, actually, you know, to me as a comic fan and someone who's been buying manga and someone who paid $2.95 for 30 pages, that's nuts. I mean, it goes from being a big purchase to just, you know, an impulse kind of buy.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's something that I was going to ask you guys what you thought, because for some reason, you know, you were talking with Chris about the collector reader mentality, and it's like the limited number of manga stuff that I've bought, the trades, for some reason, even though they're and maybe because they're published nicer, they're printed on, you know, with a better spine, they're thicker, there's more weight to them, I don't seem to have the same mentality as opposed to the singles that I buy of American comics, where I bag and board them and, you know, make sure that they're kept straight and I don't want to crease them or anything. And with the trades, it's almost like, because it's so cheap, it's a throwaway. You know, it's like I don't worry about necessarily keeping them in good condition because it's so inexpensive. I'm purchasing it just simply to buy it like I would a paperback book, and I think that's part of the success of it too. It's, you know, paperback books opposed to hardcovers or something that is in this case it's flimsier, so you have to keep it more protected.
Well, I mean, whenever you go and you buy Ultimate Spider-Man number one, you throw it in a bag and a board and you go, wow, you know, I'm gonna keep that with the rest of my collection, because you know, you never know whenever something is going to spike in value. Whenever you go and you buy, you know Monster volume one from Barnes and Noble, you're not buying that going, wow, you know, this $9.95 paperback, oh, it might be worth $50 in a couple years. You know, does that make sense?
Yeah, that's part of it, too. I mean, like Sal said, it goes from, it's not a collectible, it's just a book that you buy from the bookstore, you know, just like any other paperback. And I'm kind of anal with my paperbacks, and when I read a book, I kind of want to keep it nice, but, you know, I don't really care. It's not like you're saving it for collectible reasons, just, you know, you have it on the shelf, you know, maybe you'll look at it later, or whatever the case is, but that is a big part of it.
Listen to AroundComics.com. It's not just for 12-year-old boys, it's for 13-year-old boys, too.
The main difference is, and this is one of the problems that these American companies have had, is that we have, you know, the standards, the cultural standards of, you know, what we consider decent or appropriate for kids are very different from Japan and Europe and to the U.S. So what you end up with, why a lot of people are really kind of are upset with, is that a lot of times we get you know, comics that are meant for younger audiences, but because there's one thing, there might be a child, you know, one of the main characters who's naked for a shot or something, which is perfectly fine for kids in Japan, but in America that gives you a teen rating or something. So what happens is that, just like with movies, you know, these publishers want the books to be teen or appropriate for younger readers because that's where their fan base is. So if there's too much nudity, if there's too much violence or something like that, some of these companies are breaking down and they're editing the books to fit into that demographic. So some people don't care. Fans are really upset, some of them, but that's how it is always.
It certainly goes to the, you know, I mean, that's a bigger issue as far as the cultural differences between, you know, here and there. And on the one side of it, you can't really blame the publishing companies on either side of it. But in regards to the, you know, in regards to the cultural differences, let's talk about, to try and give people a better understanding of it, some of the definitions of the terms that are used with manga.
Okay. First off, like we said, manga or manga, however you want to say it, basically just refers to Japanese comics. It's a word kind of like sheep, where there is no plural. I mean, it's the plural of itself. So you say, you know, I like that one manga, or I like those 10 manga. It's all the same. We talked about already manhwa, which is the Korean comics, and those you can tell on the shelf because they're Korean's actually written and read the same way that English is. So it goes from left to right. So Korean comics will be in the normal traditional English reading order with the art the same way that we're used to. Now, the three big topics I want to talk about, because these come up a lot in what's going on right now, is the demographic titles. For example, shonen. Shonen Jump. Shonen is a word that means young men. So anything that's quote-unquote shonen is aimed at that audience, you know, 10 to 16-year-old males, pretty much. It's going to be, you know, typically, you know, action, fighting, a nerdy guy, you know, falling in love with a whole bunch of girls, things like that.
And that's what I find interesting is that they do have, you know, their genres are named. I mean, shonen is, if it's a shonen book, it's for young males. If it's, you know, talk about that. I mean, as far as, I'm sure that's what you're going to go to, but it just seems interesting that they sort of categorize everything so diligently.
Well, you know, the reason why, what I think is that it's just like on television. It's done by demographic because they sell magazines to certain demographics. That way they can target ads at certain demographics, and they can sell. They say, this magazine is aimed at young boys, so we're going to have stories that we think appeal to young boys, and then we're going to advertise, you know, sneakers or tech or whatever the things that young boys want. The same thing goes with, like I said, the other one, the big one right now that's really getting a lot of press is the shoujo manga, which is just the word shoujo means young girls. And that's where we're really seeing a huge boom in the sales right now, is the fact that for once, I mean, we are getting girls reading comics. And it's definitely not American comics, unfortunately for a lot of people, but they're reading, and they're really buying this stuff in droves. Now, one of the things I do want to point out is that shonen and shoujo, they're not really genres. What they are is just kind of, like I said, a demographic category. So you could have a shoujo girls book that's full of action, that's, you know, seems like it might be a boy's title, but just for whatever reason, it's not categorized as that. The main way to tell is usually who is the main character. If it's a male main character, a lot of times it's, you know, aimed at males. If it's a female main character, it's aimed at boys, but that's just very generalized kind of story, and so don't hold me to that stuff. The other category that we talk about is seinen manga, which is manga that's aimed at the older males, the, you know, 20, 30-year-old males. And that's the kind of thing we've only gotten a few titles here that fit that, and most of them that we got, I think, were ones that came out back in the early 90s. You know, stuff like Akira is aimed at older audiences. Stuff like, you know, The Samurai, Lone Wolf and Cub, and Crying Freeman, and some of those things, like Monster, for example, again, those are all aimed at older males, but I have a really bad feeling that those are just not going to sell here, because those aren't the people that are buying the books right now.
Which is kind of a shame if you think about how influential some of that stuff has been in comics and even, you know, films, TV, and, you know, something like Lone Wolf and Cub has gone on, you know, you see that, in everything from Frank Miller's work to, you know, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles to Kill Bill Volume 2, you know, I mean...
Yeah, and people actually say that cartoon Samurai Jack has a lot of influence from that.
So...
Well, I think that we're seeing one of the differences between the American comic book consumer and the American manga consumer, and it's largely an age difference. You know, would you say that the majority of consumers in this country that buy manga are teenagers, and probably the majority of the people that buy American comics are college age and much older?
Yeah, you know, I don't want to pin myself down without seeing hard facts, but that seems to be the way that it's going right now. I did a little survey in my anime and manga club that I have at my high school of the 30-some members that are in there, and of the 30 people, almost all of them said that they read manga, and none of them said that they read American comics or knew anyone that read American comics. And that was mostly 14, 15-year-old mix of both boys and girls.
What the heck's wrong with them? No. It's understandable, though. I mean, it. You know, I think one of the big things is that it's more accessible. It's in an easier format to get your hands on and understand what you're getting. You know, they have it clearly defined. They explain how to read it in just about every book you pick up. It's simpler to ingest. You walk into a bookstore and buy a digest that's got 300 pages, and you know kind of what you're getting before you even purchase it. You walk into a comic shop, and you know you have no clue if you haven't been there before, if you don't know exactly what you're looking for. Most of them,
and it's clearly defined where to jump on. Volume one.
Exactly.
You walk into a comic shop and it's Fantastic Four number 457. Well, gosh, I can't start here. I've got to find, you know, number one first.
Absolutely. So I think that's a huge part of it. What other kind of terms should people look, you know, be on the lookout for?
One of the big terms that is going to come into play a lot more is this term OEL manga, which stands for Original English Language Manga, which is more or less, it's American comics by American authors that sort of use some of the graphical conventions or cliches of the traditional Japanese manga. A lot of people, and myself included, I don't really believe that they should be called manga, because really, they're just like any other alternative comic that you'd find in the United States. They do, you know, they're influenced by manga stories, and so, you know, it's kind of iffy. They had big news with this stuff lately is because Tokyopop put two of these English manga strips into newspapers a few months ago. I don't know if you remember reading that in the news or not. But it was kind of a big deal, and there's also sort of an OEL manga strip that's running in the Cosmo Girl magazine. And so Tokyopop, they're really putting a lot of their future efforts into publishing and finding this kind of stuff. So I'm not a big fan, but I know we have a person on the forum, Torch Song, or Al, as he's known, who works as a reviewer of manga of sorts for IGN, and he sent in an audio clip kind of talking about some of the OEL books that he thinks that we should be on the lookout for.
Hello, this is Al, Torch Song, if you're a regular at the Comic Geek Speak forums. Matt asked if I could do a quick bit on OEL manga, and I immediately said, no frickin' way, dude. Then he said he'd throw in a back issue of Identity Desk, and I said, oh, I'll have it for you by the weekend. That said, let's start with the obvious question. What the hell is OEL? OEL stands for Original English Language Manga, and the debate's hot and heavy over whether you can really call it manga or not. Everyone has an opinion on it, so here's mine. Manga comes from Japan. Manhwa is Korean manga, and OEL doesn't come from Japan or Korea. Pure and simple, there's little difference between an OEL book and the indie books you're going to find every day at your local comic book store. And that doesn't mean these books aren't worth your time. Some of them are quite good. In fact, here's three recent releases you might want to check out. The Abandoned by Ross Campbell is the classic zombie tale with a little southern flair thrown in. When the residents of a nursing home suddenly rise from their beds with a taste for the flesh of the living in a small Georgia town, the survivors are forced to band together to keep on surviving. The book follows the conventional zombie storyline we all know and love, but like most zombie movies, it's all about the characters and what they're willing to go through to make it out alive. If you're a zombie fan, this is a solid read for you. Sorcerers and Secretaries is a little something for the ladies. Okay, I read it too. It's the story of a girl so wrapped up in fantasy, the sword and sorcery type, that the real world fails to live up to her expectations. This makes it particularly difficult when she catches the eye of someone who just might be her one true love. Thing is, this guy doesn't stand a chance against the imaginary sorcerer she keeps dreaming about. Creator Amy Kim Ganter has received some pretty good accolades for this book, and it might be worth checking out if you're a fan of movies like Labyrinth. One of my favorite OELs is I Love Halloween by Benjamin Roman and Keith Giffen. No big shocker there, because I'll usually pick up anything Keith Giffen attaches his name to. But it's the art that really sells this one. It's like a perverse cartoon you might see if Nicktoons were run by Satan, and the storyline's just as wicked, but it's also morbidly funny. If you have a really dark sense of humor, this is your book. It's not for the kids, but it's definitely worth your time. The second volume of a planned 3-issue series is out now. Any way you package it, whatever you want to call it, good comics are good comics, and some of the OEL out there is well worth your time. Whether we want to call it manga or not is a debate that probably won't end when you get done with this podcast. But no matter how much of a manga purist you might be, don't let it stop you from checking some of these books out. Tokyo Pop has a ton of OEL titles coming out in 2006. It's a genre that's definitely going to be around for some time, so why not embrace it? I hope this helped give you some insight into the wonderful world of OEL. This is Torch Song, and I'll see you in the manga section.
All right, well, thanks, Torch Song. That's why I have to thank him on the forum. That was interesting. OEL is not something that...
Segment.
Yeah, he's. I feel a podcast in his future. But I haven't picked up any OEL. Matt, have you had pretty good luck with it so far?
You know what? Like I said, I'm really a snob because I don't pick up the manhwa stuff either. I don't look at the Korean comics. I don't look at the OEL stuff. And it's not that I don't think it's good. I don't know. It's sort of like, I guess kind of like the person that won't buy American beer. You know, they only buy the imports. Certain brand or something. I don't know. I like the manga official kind of from Japan stuff, and there's more than enough of that to keep me going, so I just haven't really explored the other thing. I do want to mention, though, the one big, really big smash success of original English language manga stuff is the comic Mega Tokyo by Fred Gallagher, which is started as an online web comic, but has done really pretty well in book form. In fact, he just... he was being published by Dark Horse, but he just jumped ship over to DC's CMX line recently and made a lot of waves with that announcement.
Do you think that OEL is a good jumping-on place for people that want to get a taste of manga before they, jump into getting the full-fledged trades? Or would you suggest, just go to Borders and dive right in?
Well, quite frankly, I mean, like you said in the segment, OEL stuff, to me, it's just like any other independent comic. And I'm an independent comic fan, so, it'll be good, it'll be bad. It's not necessarily going to be manga, though, is what I'm trying, I guess what I'm saying. It still could be a good comic. Check it out. I guess if manga's too Japan-centric or something for you, then maybe that's the answer, but I really don't have that much experience, so I don't want to say either way.
AroundComics.com, your source for discussion, news, and reviews about your favorite comics and creators. New podcasts available every Monday. Go to www.aroundcomics.com.
Let me just move on to one other thing that I want to talk about as far as terms. Like anime, which has a very active fan-subbing community, manga also has a fan-subbing community, what's called Scanlation by some. Back in the early days, what you'd find on like BBS's and Rec Arts manga or something like that, you'd find people would literally translate an entire manga volume line by line and write it out as a text script, so that if you bought the original, you could sit there next to your computer screen and like go through and read the script and follow along with what was going on. Now, with the advent of scanning technology and Photoshop and stuff, what you get is that as soon as a popular series comes out in the Japanese magazine, you've got somebody that's scanned it in, they have translated it, they've relettered it, and then they posted it online. So it's anything that you want to see, a lot of stuff that you cannot get here, a lot of the genres that aren't, you know, for those young readers that you can't find here will show up, and they're available in Scanlation if you can find them. Now, I won't tell you where to go for that, but do some searches on Google. I'm sure you can figure it out.
Yes, Around Comics does not endorse the piracy of comic books.
Well, you know what? This is the thing. To me, that's different than somebody taking the Marvel comic off the shelf and scanning it.
Mm-hmm. It's an available issue.
Semantically, I know it is. Technically, it's not. You know, it's not legal, but they are actually doing the work of translating the material by themselves. They're not stealing someone else's translation. So I guess it's kind of half and half, gray area sort of thing. But let's not get
into
muddy.
That. That's a whole other episode.
Now I know that we have another sound piece that Lana Taylor sent us on her favorite segment of manga, or at least one of her favorite segments of manga. Why don't we just go ahead and play that? I'm not going to... I don't think it needs any introduction. I think, other than if you don't know who Lana Taylor is, she also does a podcast called I Read Comics. And if you haven't checked it out before, you probably should, because it's, if nothing else, interesting.
Hey there, this is Lana Taylor from the I Read Comics podcast, and I'm here to tell you about what I did on my summer vacation. No, wait, that's wrong. I'm here to tell you why I like yaoi. I like yaoi for a lot of reasons. First, let me say that it's not for everybody. It's a very specialized form of manga, and to my mind, it's kind of like eating wasabi peas. They're really spicy, and they're really good, and they're great once in a while to add a little flavor to your diet, but there's no way that you could live on them all the time. So I like my manga and my yaoi in small doses. To start off, I like gay porn, and that's a big part of it, because yaoi is all about boy-on-boy love. Lots of women like gay porn, lots of straight women, lots of straight-ish women like it, so it's not as unusual as you might think. Another big part of yaoi, because it's boy-on-boy love, and the boy is the important part there, is that there's a lot of angst involved. It's all about romantic relationships and where things goes wrong and why one guy can't get another guy. So it's very angsty in a soap opera-ish way, and I like angst once in a while, too. That's kind of why I like shows like Deep Space Nine. The other things I like about it include the plots, which are often incomprehensible. They're incredibly convoluted and often require multiple readings of a book to figure out exactly what's going on. And frankly, even after I've read a book 6 or 7 times, I still can't figure out what's going on. But, you know, who cares? Because there are pretty boys having sex with each other. Now, I do have to say that the sex is not as graphic as one might like it to be, because according to the way yaoi is done in Japan, you can't actually show, say, penetration or even sex organs, so there tends to be little clouds of fluffy things happening where you might expect to see actual sex. I also like the stylized art that's the case in most manga, and it's true for yaoi as well, that everyone is drawn with those really big eyes, and there's a lot of emphasis on hair and very long fingers, and of course they're all extremely Western looking. They don't look like Japanese people, but I think it's kind of cool. It takes some getting used to the first time you open a manga book or a yaoi book. You wonder what the hell's going on, but soon you begin to understand what it's about. I also like the fact that most manga and yaoi actually come from Japan, and even with a very good translation, there are still cultural issues that don't really translate well from Japanese society to American society, and there's an interesting cultural dissonance that happens where you have characters complaining that they've tried to give a present to someone and that person didn't accept it, and therefore it was not only an insult to the giver of the present, but it was an insult to the present as well, and somehow the present lost face. And that's just kind of a strange concept, but it's good. I think one reason why a lot of women like yaoi manga in particular is that it's a chance to see a romantic, angst-filled relationship between two boys, and there isn't the same kind of power imbalance that you always get in any heterosexual romance, no matter who the two people involved is, because one of them is a woman, the woman is always in a lesser position than the man. So you can enjoy the angst and enjoy all of the soap opera antics that go on without it personally affecting you and identifying too much with either of the characters. And like most manga, there are stereotypes that show up in just about every yaoi story that you see. There's the guy who is the cold, aloof, sexy, powerful one, and he's usually really tall. And then there's the other guy who's the one who's in the powerless, but less powerful position. And he's usually quite feminized, which also takes a little bit of getting used to. But he is a man. He does have a penis, even though it's not actually drawn that way. If you want to find out a lot more about yaoi and the difference between yaoi and shonen-ai, which is a different form of boy-on-boy love that doesn't have actual sex in it, go to Wikipedia and look it up, because there's a lot of really good information there. So, in conclusion, I like yaoi because it has weird art, incomprehensible plots, and gay porn. Thanks.
All right, Sal, what more do you need?
Hey, you know, it truly is a testament to that there is something out there for everyone.
Wayna talks about yaoi quite a bit on her podcast, I Read Comics. So if you're interested in that, and she goes more in depth in a lot of different specific stories, check her out. And she also has another podcast called Look at His Butt, which is really a lot of fun if you're a Star Trek fan that likes to make fun of some of the things in the Star Trek universe. So I want to thank Lena for sending that in.
Yeah, that was nice of her. The reason I asked her to do that, actually, is because, believe it or not, for heterosexual males, it might be a little hard to understand, but that there's actually been a lot of success with those books being published here in the U.S. So there's a readership. I don't know that. I guess it's, you know, the same appeal that there used to be. You always find those kind of like Kirk and Spock love stories on the internet or something. I don't know. People seem to.
I never found those. You may have, Matt.
Thanks.
Well, I think she brought up a good point about you know, the relationships, and if you're a female reader reading a typical American relationship between a man and a woman, you know, you generally, you're going to see the male in the dominant role and the female in a submissive sort of role. And in this, you know, like she pointed out, you have something a little different than that. You don't necessarily, you know, you're not looking at, you know, some sort of, I don't want to say sexist or misogynist, but you don't have that come up in that sort of a story.
That's true.
So, I mean, that may be a big part of it. I don't know. I mean, I honestly have no idea.
Well, the big appeal to the people that actually buy this, as she said, are straight women. These are comics that are made for women, idealized kind of relationship. They're not, you know, aimed at. They're not written for gay men by gay men or anything like that. They're very kind of, you know, idealized, unrealistic sort of stories.
I tell you what, guys. Let's move on to some final thoughts on manga as where it fits into our world of comics. I'll let our expert Matt start off. Where do you see manga going from here?
Well, one of the things I wanted to touch on with the sales is that the biggest, really surprising success that we've seen out of this whole thing is the sales of manga to the young girl or the teen girl audience. There's a series that's called Fruits Basket that is just, I mean, the thing, it's got 12 volumes, and all 12 volumes are on the book sale chart, and they all last year sold 40,000 copies each. And there's no advertising, and there's like no, so I don't know, it's coming out of this need. There's a desire, there's something there that's fulfilling the needs of these readers that American comics aren't doing or have not figured out how to do. So, you know, I don't know if there's anything that we can do with our comic industry. I mean, aside from trying to emulate what's working, I mean, I don't know what else. No matter how hard we try, I just don't think that we're ever going to sell, you know, Spider-Man Loves Mary Jane to that many girls out there. The way I see this going, as far as in general, right now sales are still on the upswing. The more anime series that tie into the manga, the better they're going to sell. But we're already seeing a lot of the kind of smaller manga groups get into trouble with sales. They don't have the big licenses. They're kind of out of luck, you know. A lot of their sales, selling to bookstores, is kind of a double-edged sword because you have returnable merchandise. And a lot of these smaller publishers are finding that, you know, they're only selling 1,000 or 2,000 copies of their book. And it's just, you know, it's kind of a crowded marketplace right now. So the way I see this breaking down is that you're going to get even further dominance by those big two publishers. It's going to be very property-driven, very, you know, the bestsellers are going to be the things that are on TV and tie in with the figures and the animation and everything else. And I'm hoping that we're going to see expansion of comics or manga aimed at the older audience, but the way things are going and the way that the sales have been for most of those titles, I unfortunately don't hold out a lot of hope for that stuff.
Well, Sal, your thoughts on manga?
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting how you look, you know, listening to the history of manga and where we're at now here in this country with it. It sort of parallels, you know, the big two companies now. You know, you have Marvel and DC that had huge readership in the 40s and 50s. And as those readers grew older, you know, they lost a lot of that. I think, you know, I mean, not being an expert in any way on manga, but I think you're kind of seeing that same thing now. You're seeing huge numbers of young kids reading manga, but as they grow older, unless you have things that will interest them as they get older, you're going to lose a lot of that readership. I think, luckily for manga, they have that. They do already have that. They have plenty of stuff that is geared towards older readers, so they have an advantage there, where, you know, Marvel and DC are sort of stuck doing the same thing they've been doing and trying to change that as opposed to create anything new. So I don't, you know, it's hard to say. Will it, you know, will it be a fad? I don't think so. I think you're going to see it change. I don't think it'll ever, you know, it'll stay at the success that it's seeing now. It may still have a ways up to go, but I think at some point, you know, it'll certainly fall. But I don't think it's gonna, you know, it won't ever disappear at this point. The world's too small in that sense anymore for something like that to happen. But, you know, I myself have not been a huge fan of it. I can't say that I am a fan of manga. I've read some. I just don't like reading it backwards. To me, it's backwards. I'm not a huge fan of a lot of the art. But that's just me. There has been stuff that I have enjoyed a lot. But I can certainly see the appeal, and I can certainly see why they've been successful, both creatively and business-wise. They seem to really know what they're doing, and they're succeeding at it.
Well, I think you're right as far as the only way that this, I think, is really going to end, or if it's going to fall, is the fact that if the current audience right now, these young teens, if they feel that they've outgrown it, or if there isn't a next step, if there's not a next, you know, more adult level to go to, then I think that we are going to have some trouble. But you know, if they're banking on just as kids get older, they're just going to keep buying into it, then, you know, who knows?
Well, you'll have your core audience. I think it'll be a lot like today with American comics, that you'll have your core audience of people that are still reading stuff that, you know, maybe isn't necessarily written for adults, but unless they, you know, there's just no way they're going to be able to keep the kind of readership they have now as those people, you know, grow into their 20s and 30s.
I'll agree with you guys, and my final thoughts on it is that manga is different than comics. It's sequential art. It has a lot of similarities to it, but I really kind of consider them more cousins than brothers and sisters. There's certainly a lot to learn from manga if you are Marvel or DC, especially because they have the publishing power to collect and emulate what manga is doing. But I think that we need to be careful to compare the two and take one business model from manga and try and move it over into American comics. Like, they're very different, and I don't think that you'll ever see them be side by side. And you know, I think that we touched on a lot of the bigger points about manga. There's certainly more to discuss, but I want to thank Matt for kind of starting us off on this. I'm sure that that Matt would love to help anyone out with any recommendations, so you can go ahead and send us an email at info@aroundcomics.com, and we'll make sure that he gets a hold of it. He is very knowledgeable about it, and I want to thank him for teaching us about manga today.
Well, I hope I didn't put you to sleep.
And there's a lot to learn. Let's move on. It is time for Wire to Wire comic news.
These are your top headlines for the week of March 20th, 2006. Tommy Lee Edwards, now a Marvel exclusive. Artist Tommy Lee Edwards has sketched out an exclusive deal with the House of Ideas. Edwards' lush painted graphics and detailed illustrations have not only been admired by comic fans, but have also been devoured by followers of advertising, animation, movies, children's books, magazines, and video games. When asked about his upcoming projects, Edwards said, "I'm painting a pile of covers for Daredevil right now." He continued that the main project he'll be spending the first year on is a 5-issue series called Bullet Points. It's written by J. Michael Straczynski and involves a huge chunk of the Marvel Universe. Some of the main characters are Reed Richards, the Hulk, Iron Man, Peter Parker, Steve Rogers, and Doctor Strange. The Darkness, PS3 game. No matter where you look, darkness is coming. One of the new places you can look is the April 2006 issue of PlayStation Magazine, which features a darkness cover and 9 whopping pages of coverage. The Top Cow Productions smash hit property, The Darkness, is the first PlayStation 3 game to grace the cover of the prestigious magazine. It's on sale now. The Darkness video game, developed by Starbreeze and published by 2K Games, is slated for a release as a launch game with Sony's upcoming PlayStation 3. Darkness comic book writer Paul Jenkins has written the script to the game. Jack Kirby returns to Marvel. Marvel announced that it will publish a comic series based on a Jack Kirby property beginning in July. Jack Kirby's Galactic Bounty Hunters, with characters and concepts created by Kirby, as expanded on by his daughter Lisa Kirby and longtime Kirby associate Mike Thibodeau, will be published by Marvel under its Icon imprint. Other Kirby characters, including Captain Victory, will also appear in the book. 1 year later, continues to sell out. The excitement over DC Comics 1 year later continues as Nightwing number 118 has sold out at the publisher and is going back to press for a new printing. The Nightwing number 118 second printing reprints the story by Bruce Jones with art by Joe Dodd and Bitt and will feature a recolored version of the cover by Jock. It is available for order now and scheduled to arrive in stores on April 12th. Who wants to be a superhero? The Sci-Fi Channel, Nash Entertainment, and legendary comic book creator Stan Lee will produce a 6-episode, 1-hour weekly competition reality series that will challenge a lucky few to create their very own superhero and reward the winner with the best reality competition prize yet, immortality. All you'll need is an original idea for a superhero, a killer costume, and some real superhero mojo. The winner of the 6-week competition will walk away with their superhero immortalized in a new comic book created by Stan Lee himself. It gets better. The winning character will also appear in an original Sci-Fi Channel movie. If you think you've got what it takes and have an original superhero inside of you, put on your costume now and call FSA Casting at 310-360-6630. Ennis and Roberts are just some good old boys. Garth Ennis and newly signed exclusive DC artist Derek Roberts are working together on a project for Wildstorm called The Boys. According to Ennis, The Boys are a CIA team assigned to watch, investigate, occasionally blackmail, and now and again kick the shit out of, and when necessary, kill superheroes. The whole idea is to keep super people in line. The Boys is due to hit stands in October. Batman Year 100 sells out. The first two chapters of the futuristic Batman Year 100 miniseries, written and illustrated by Paul Pope, have sold out at DC Comics and are going back to press. Featuring recolored versions of Pope's original covers, the Batman Year 100 No. 1 and Batman Year 100 No. 2 reprints are scheduled to arrive in stores April 19th. Witchblade in anime. Japanese-owned GDH has obtained the rights to create an animated version of the popular U.S. comic Witchblade by Top Cow Productions. The concept of this action-adventure fantasy involves the Witchblade itself, an ancient weapon passed down throughout time that selects one female bearer each generation. The original Witchblade concept is used in the Witchblade animated series, but the story has been localized for the Japanese market. The main character is a Japanese woman, and the setting is Tokyo of the near future. DC announces Green Lantern promotion. Tying into the upcoming Green Lantern Corps miniseries written by Dave Gibbons and illustrated by Patrick Gleason and Prentice Rollins, DC Comics offers qualifying retailers the chance to order promotional Green Lantern rings. For every 50 copies of Green Lantern Corps No. 1 ordered by May 17th, retailers may order one bag of 50 Green Lantern promotional rings. Please note that supplies are limited and may be allocated. Rings are for promotional use only, and they do not actually give the wearer of the ring superpowers. Brody's Law goes to Marcosia. Marcosia Enterprises has signed the critically acclaimed comic book series Brody's Law. Brody's Law, written by veteran comic book scribe Alan Grant, has been a massive success for its creators David Burcham and Daley Osiemi, and the series has already created a much-deserved buzz within the comic industry and community. The first volume of the trade paperback has seen several printings, with 500 copies of the trade paperback sold at the 2005 San Diego Comic-Con alone. The series will continue from issue 7 at Marcosia and will be available in June 2006 through Diamond Comic Distributors. The same month, along with several of the Chimora Studios trade paperbacks, a brand new printing of the 144-page Brody's Law trade paperback will be made available with additional concept artwork from Burcham. Harry Marcos, managing director and owner of Marcosia, comments on the signing of Brody's Law. Brody's Law is without a doubt one of the most groundbreaking comic book series to come out of the UK in the past decade, and it shows that a great story can be appreciated the world over. David and Daley's work ethic is second to none, and when you see the hours of work they've put into this series, you can see that they love what they are doing. Marvel announces all new exclusive deals. Marvel Comics has been on a signing rampage lately, handing out exclusive deals like variant covers of X-Force number 1. Here's a list of the last four creators to sign exclusive deals at the House of Ideas. Talented penciler Yannick Paquette, fresh-faced writer and filmmaker Zeb Wells, talented journeyman Scotty Young, and fan-favorite artist J. Scott Campbell. These have been your top headlines for the week of March 20th, 2006. For the full version of these and other stories, go to AroundComics.com, your source for the best in comics news, reviews, and opinions.
All right, guys, there you go. This is this week's news. We'll start at the top here. Tommy Lee Edwards is now a Marvel exclusive. We can tie that into the last story. Looks like Marvel is buying up all the talent out there. What do you guys think about exclusive deals?
Well, you know, we've talked about this before. It's for me, I understand why a creator would want to sign an exclusive deal. It gives them stability, that kind of thing. But, you know, Marvel and DC has all this great talent tied up, and they're not able to create, you know, original stuff that that maybe we would have seen them do otherwise.
Yeah, I think it's good for the creators in some regards, because I think the big thing is health insurance. Unfortunately, that seems to be a big draw for an exclusive deal, and also contracted work. They're guaranteed work for a certain amount of time. We actually talked to Phil Hester today, and he had some great thoughts on exclusive contracts and why he chooses not to do that for right now. He gave some ideas what it would take for him to sign an exclusive deal, but sign of the times, I believe. Matt, you?
Are all these guys that are signing exclusives, are they all finding things for them to do that are really worth their talents? I don't know. I'm just asking you, because I'm not the biggest Marvel follower.
Well, and it's not just Marvel. DC signs lots of talent to exclusive contracts. And I think it depends on the deal. Phil actually was talking about Warren Ellis, and Warren Ellis is signed to an exclusive with Marvel, but under his contract, he can write for just about anyone except for DC. So it depends on what the deal is. I think each one is different. And because you're signed exclusive as an artist, you may be able to write for anyone, or vice versa. If you're a writer under an exclusive deal, you may be able to do art for a variety of different companies. So I think it's on a case-by-case basis. We'll move on. A couple video game headlines going both ways. One is Halo is going to be a graphic novel under Marvel. Wait, is it a graphic or an ongoing series? Actually, graphic novel. And then a comic actually going to video games is The Darkness. And I thought the interesting thing about that story was that Paul Jenkins is actually going to write the script for the game.
You know what the thing is about that, though, is there. I don't know what it is about us. We cannot seem to cross-promote anything. I would be highly suspicious if anybody that bought that game actually went and bought the comics. Most people that are going to buy the Spider-Man game, they're going to buy it anyway. I don't know how much difference that makes to the average guy on the street, but I guess the proof's in the pudding, so we'll just have to wait and see what it looks like.
Yeah, it's just a piece of the pie, and they've got to work a lot of different angles, and whether it's movies and cartoons and video games and toys and everything that they're already doing, I just don't know if it's increasing readership. It has to at some point, and I don't think that you can take any one facet of it and say 50,000 people bought Ultimate Spider-Man the video game, and we think that 5,000 of them are going to read the comic book. There's no way to gauge it. We kind of talked about it in the manga spot, that there's really no way to track sales. else because of the way that, that Diamond tracks that, and so it's a lot of unknown quantities. But you know, it is nice that those are crossing over into the video game market. Move on. A Jack Kirby property is coming to Marvel. It's going to be his Galactic Bounty Hunters. Is there still enough interest from people to go out, if it has Jack Kirby's name on it, to go out and check it out?
Well, I certainly think so. I mean, why wouldn't you?
I have one word for you. Tops. Do you guys remember when the Tops comics tried to launch their whole line on Kirby kind of throw-off concepts?
Well,
I don't know.
I don't think
it's
really the same thing.
Sales.
I don't think it's
a guarantee, but... I think a lot of that has to do with timing. And, you know, that was at a time when people were starting to get real weary of stuff out there. Kirby is enough of an iconic name, especially now that, you know, unfortunately he's passed away, that for the longtime comic reader, if it has his name on there, I think they'll check it out. Now, whether it's good or not, we'll have to see, but, you know, I think it will drum up a certain amount of interest.
Well, it's also in the presentation. I mean, it's, you know, you don't have some nobody doing this, you know, kind of raping, you know, Kirby's name. It's his daughter and his longtime, you know, partner that are doing it. So, only time will tell.
Moving on, this is no big story. Nightwing sold out. DC, once again, another 1 year later title is going back for a second printing. It looks like they are just an out-of-control steamroller right now, and good for them.
I think Dan Dito's just going around buying all these copies so he can republish them.
How many copies did they actually print? I think that's the question, because... Yeah. I mean, how many, I don't know, how many sales, how many did they print? If they only printed 20,000 copies for a huge, you know, everyone knows that these are going to be big demand on these first issues for 1 year later. So, I don't know, if they're underprinting just to be able to, you know, kind of hype themselves up, it doesn't mean as much as if it's actually...
Well, you know, I would prefer that if they're doing that, if they're, you know, intentionally underprinting on these, first of all, that doesn't make much sense from the printing standpoint, from a volume. So, I don't know, they may have these warehoused somewhere, you know, but I would rather see them underprint and drum up interest by telling people that they've sold out than printing, you know, 5 million copies and flooding the market with stuff that's going to sit on retailer shelves for the next year and end up in the 25-cent bin.
But if you're hyping this as a huge jumping on point, I mean, doesn't that defeat the whole purpose to have sellouts?
Well, it's also creating a sense of urgency for the consumer. We're so conditioned, I think, now to waiting for the trade or waiting for things to hit the dollar bins, that if you can create a sense of urgency with the consumer, you're working your way into guaranteeing a success. So from a marketing standpoint, it's if that's indeed what they're doing.
Plus, we don't know how many they printed, so to say one way or the other is...
Well, I know. That's why I'd be interested to know.
We'll move on. Who here wants to be a superhero?
Me.
I'm working on my costume now, and I'm all ready to go meet Stan Lee, and yeah.
So you guys remember Ravage 2099?
No.
Can't say that I know that one.
Oh, I'm just trying to say, because like you'll be immortalized in a Stan Lee comic, and I'm just thinking, when's the last time, like 1965, the last time that Stan had a good comic? I mean, I love the guy, but you know, he hasn't had a great track record of publishing stuff in the last few years.
Yeah, we'll see that the whoever gets to star in their own comic book. I don't know if we'll be doing a reprint story on that one, but it's cool to see that Stan is still out there, and he's such a recognizable guy. You know, I can't. Can you guys think of anyone else that would be the person that Sci-Fi would use for this?
No,
Joe Quesada. No, I don't know nobody. It's Stan. One thing that Stan always did great is market himself in comic books, and you know, regardless of his track record in the last, you know, however many years, he's still a legend. And you know.
Yeah, I mean, he's a great, personable guy. It's just kind of, I don't know, it'd be kind of funny. I don't know, what are they going to have these guys like, okay, who can rescue someone from the burning building, or what?
It's a reality TV show. I wouldn't take it too seriously, but it's, you know, it's fun and funny, and I'll watch it. What the heck? Check it out.
Yeah, I know they're going to, but I really hope that they don't play up the whole ridiculous fanboy aspect of it. You know, the pulling guys out of their parents' basements and that kind of stuff.
Well, who do you think I really hope that's going to show?
I know that's what it's going to be. I cringe. Next story. Garth Ennis is working with Derek Roberts on a new series called The Boys.
I'm going on record as saying that's going to be my favorite series of this year. Before I've seen anything, I don't care. It's going to be...
Big talk.
It's going to be great.
Be careful, because I put out a preemptive guarantee that Annihilation was going to be great.
Yeah, but everybody told you that was going to...
and Annihilation just started coming out, so we got some time. But yeah,
sorry. What?
The concept of this story is pretty cool. A team assigned to watch, investigate, occasionally blackmail, and now and again kick the shit out of, and whenever necessary, kill superheroes. That sounds like it's in Garth Ennis's wheelhouse.
Absolutely. If it's Garth Ennis beating the crap out of superheroes with a really good artist, gold.
Let's move on. Another sellout, Batman Year 100. Both the first and second issues have sold out on that. It's actually been a top of the stack selection twice on the show now. I know that that Sal is liking it. It's one of my favorite mini series out right now. And it looks like a lot of other people are liking it. Matt, have you picked up Batman Year 100?
I got the first issue. I've read about the first 20 pages, I think, so far. You know, I'm a big Paul Pope fan from way back, and again, this is one of those stories, like, what kind of numbers? I have a hard time thinking that DC really believed in this book that much to publish a really big print run. I think they're just finding themselves.
Whether it's a big print run or not, it had a pretty hefty price on it. I think it was what, $4.99. I'll have to take a look. So it was pretty expensive. It was it's a little bit higher quality book, and I don't know if there was a whole lot of drummed up anticipation for it. The next one, we touched on some anime earlier in the show, and Witchblade is going to anime, but they're going to change the story up a little bit, and it's going to be a Japanese based Witchblade. So it's say what you will about that series and franchise, but it's still around, and there are a lot of people that that are interested in it.
Yeah, it's kind of funny to think that series that I really have never given a crap about has spawned like a little cable TV show and all this other stuff. There's a tradition of American comics being translated into manga. I don't know if any of you guys read the Spider-Man manga that they published through Marvel a couple years ago, and they're releasing the Spawn manga right now and some other things, and it's always changed. I mean, they always change it to localize it, but I still probably won't pick it up.
Sure. Well, look for Witchblade the anime in video shelves near you soon. Next story was the Green Lantern Ring promotion. Is everybody ready to run to their local comic shop and grab their Hal Jordan replica ring?
I do want one. You know, I got the last time that DC did that, about 8 years ago, they did the same thing with giving out plastic Green Lantern rings, and I still have that. So, looking forward to
Sal, it. Are you going to run and get your ring whenever it comes out?
Probably not.
You know, I think it's nice that they're promoting, and once again, you know, with Dan DiDio and his whole ground roots local comic shop push, I think this is just one more in a series of promotions and ideas that DC is doing to drive people to the local comic shop. You know, you're not going to be able to, you know, you'll find this on eBay like crazy, I'm sure, but for most people, you're going to have to go to the local comic shop. It's something that I really respect out of DC right now. I hope that Marvel will kick in and come up with some programs to get people to the local comic shops. That will wrap up our Hardwire news for the week, and that means it is time for Top of the Stack.
Top of the stack.
That's right. It's time for Top of the Stack. It is our chance every week to let you guys know what we have been reading. I'll start off with mine. The new release this week of Squadron Supreme. It is the mainstream relaunch of Supreme Power, which was the J. Michael Straczynski title under the Max imprint for Marvel. What happened, as far as I understand it, is that Supreme Power was very popular, but it was not able to be sold in a lot of local comic shops, especially in the South, because of the Max imprint, where a lot of stores are not allowed to sell comics with adult content. Due to the popularity of the series, Marvel decided to relaunch it under the regular Marvel imprint. They're going to clean up the series a little bit. You're not going to see curse words. You're not going to see nudity. And not that those are necessarily great things in comics. I did love the gritty, realistic attitude that the book had. Yeah, that was the big draw for me, that it took a spin on the Superman story to begin with, and it wiped away the kind of glossed over look of, you know, the alien crashes to Earth, is raised by, you know, Ma and Pa on the farm, and it really put a spin on what would really happen. That I won't spoil the original Supreme Power for you, because it was very good, but it is a much more, you know, quote-unquote realistic look at what would happen. I was very scared about Squadron Supreme being retooled for, you know, the masses, but the first issue was a pleasant surprise. I got to the end of it, and to tell you the truth, I really couldn't tell the difference between the previous series run and what I had just read. The themes are still, you know, very adult. It just doesn't have the cursing and nudity, but it's very well done. It once again is written by J. Michael Straczynski. It's produced by Marvel, and the art is done very, very well by Gary Frank. If you were a little worried about Squadron Supreme, don't be. I was very impressed, and I think it's a very good relaunch of the title, and look for more of it. And that is my Top of the Stack.
You know, Chris, I think that's interesting based on our discussion a couple weeks ago about the swearing and nudity and things in comics. I think that's kind of good that they actually did a decent, you know, kind of more mature title that didn't have to resort to that kind of stuff. So glad to see.
Well, good writing is good writing, and good comics are good comics, and you don't always have to have shock value. And I think it was Tom that had a great quote that mature titles in comics appeal to the immature reader in all of us, and I think this showed that you don't have to do that.
Crap. I didn't like it nearly as much, but I guess I'm just immature. I don't know.
That's okay.
Sal, how about you? What's your Top of the Stack this week?
Well, I dug into my archive and picked up some manga, the very few that I've ever read, and we've already talked about this book a couple times on the show, Lone Wolf and Cub, Volume 1, The Assassin's Road. This is a reprint from Dark Horse. It's a small digest size. I picked it up for $10. It's like 300 pages. It's, I think, the first 10 stories from Lone Wolf and Cub. If you haven't read this before, it is classic stuff. It was done in the 1970s. If you're a fan of any type of samurai film or just good, interesting storytelling, I can't recommend it enough. It's a classic work. it has gone on to influence, you know, Frank Miller and, you know, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and, you know, Quentin Tarantino and movies and TV shows and, you know, you can't quite go wrong with it. I mean, it's just extremely good. It's interesting story about a samurai who is banished from his, I don't want to say cult,
no,
it's
almost
his, I can't think of the word. gang or whatever, and he has to become an assassin, but he also has a 3-year-old child. So it leads to some interesting scenarios when he, you know, he doesn't look at that as a hindrance. He actually uses the child to his benefit, which is really interesting sometimes to see what happens with these two characters as they go off killing his clan, former members of his clan. But it's great stuff, and like I said, you can't go wrong with it.
It's one of those books that whenever people will put up on a forum, you know, name the, you know, the great runs in comics or the essential collections to look into, and then people will put up, you know, Dark Knight Returns or Watchmen or Kingdom Come, or, you know, everyone lists those off, and then usually about 20 posts down, someone says, well, hey, you know, Lone Wolf and Cub, and then everyone replies back, oh, yeah, you know, that totally belongs there. You're right, it is a classic series.
And Dark Horse has printed, like, mm-hmm. all 20, I think there's 28 volumes they've reprinted, so you can read the entire thing.
Yeah, it was really my introduction to manga, so it is a classic. Matt, how about you? What is your top of the stack this week?
Well, my top of the stack, and this also comes from one of our listeners, Bob and his son, who's known as JLA Fan on the forums, sent in to me a suggestion for what he would want to recommend, and I'm going to agree with him here. I'm going to also go with a manga book this week, and I already talked about Monster, and that really, I think, is the best more adult book out right now, but one I like a little, slightly less, but still get into pretty well, is called Death Note, and this is one of the best-selling books right now on the bookstore scan, so it's pretty popular, and a lot of people have talked about this. It's aimed at more of an older teen audience. So again, it's got a very realistic drawing style. This is published by Viz, $7.99 for 220-some pages. And the story is this. We have a character who is a senior in high school, a brilliant, you know, model kid, model student. And one day, he's walking home from school and he finds this notebook on the ground. And the notebook turns out to have been dropped by a death god, and whoever's name he writes in the notebook will automatically die. And so it sets up kind of a situation where he decides that he's going to be kind of like a superhero or an Avenger. He's going to clean up, you know, kill all the criminals that can't be reached. And he starts off that way, but then he very quickly turns into kind of a really evil bastard, because he realizes that, you know, the police are going to be coming after him, and he starts to kill off the people that are coming after him, and so he gets into really a kind of a cat and mouse situation between him trying to do his mission to become you know, the god of the new society, and the people that are trying to stop him. So there's 4 volumes out right now, and the first 4 volumes are actually pretty tight, pretty intense story. It's gotten a lot of good press already from a lot of other people. So if you have not checked it out, then take a look at Death Note Volume 1.
All right, we will be on the lookout for Death Note. I've heard a lot of good and disturbing things on the forum about it. It's pretty graphic book.
Yeah, I sent you one of those, I believe.
Yeah, I'm getting ready to take a look at it. I got a pile of manga from Matt to go through. Well, guys, I think that is going to wrap up this episode. Once again, thank you to Matt for walking us through manga. I will invite everyone to visit us on our forum. Just go to aroundcomics.com, or you can go to comicgeekspeak.com. Our forum is partnered with Comic Geek Speak, and we would love to hear from you there. Or you can send in an email at info@aroundcomics.com. We'd love to hear what you think about the show. Sal, thank you very much. Matt, thank you. You guys have a great week, and we will see you again next week on Around Comics.
If you would like to suggest a topic, send us your comments, or are interested in becoming a panel member, email us at info@aroundcomics.com or visit the Contact Us section of our website. For that and the latest in comics news and opinions, go to www.aroundcomics.com. Music for this show provided by the Podshow Podsafe Music Network, music.podshow.com. Thank you for listening today, and remember to join us next week, where the panel will change, but our mission stays the same, bringing you the best in discussion, news, and reviews in and around comics.